A few years ago, I was at a dinner party, and pretty quickly after we sat down, I told the young woman on my right that I was a vicar, so she asked me about sex. Well, it's not a boring thing to ask, is it? And when the subject comes up, one longs for people to get hold of the first couple of chapters of the Maker's instructions, Genesis 1 and 2. So very gently, you know, the tone's winsome. There's a sort of wry smile. But what am I looking to be saying about this subject? Well, number one, sex is physical. So Genesis 1:27, God made human beings male and female. It's amazing. And as Adam sees Eve, he exclaims, "Whoa, my heart's filling up as I see her." It's amazing to be attracted to each other, male and female. But that's not all Genesis 1 and 2 says. Genesis 2 tells me sex is relational. So Genesis 2:18, it's not good for man to be alone. God looks at Adam alone and he says, that's not good. And he creates Eve and intercourse. Sex is there to combat aloneness. But it's not just physical, it's not just relational, it's also emotional. At the end of Genesis chapter 2, we read that Adam and Eve were naked together and they felt no shame. Deeply emotional. So our sexuality is wired into our souls. It's profoundly emotional as sex burns the memory of the other person into my soul for life. You know each other that deeply. It's a lifelong bond. The word is dabak. There's glue there. Lifelong glue. But it's not just physical. It's not just relational. It's not just emotional. It's also spiritual. So Paul the Apostle takes these words in Genesis 1 and 2 and he takes them into one of his letters in Ephesians chapter 5 and he says, if you want to know how Christ loves the church, look at a husband and wife together in intercourse. Look at their commitment, look at their experience, and that's what it means that Christ loves and knows the church. So it's profoundly spiritual. Now, just to say, we've got a conference coming up on this subject, an evangelism conference, A Better Story. We've got to tell this story better to the culture. The culture's in ruins on this issue. Actually, the interview was partly on that. The church is not even holding to it, and it's such a wonderful message. And so A Better Story, Glyn Harrison is going to come and help us think through how we tell this better story of sexuality to the culture on the 3rd of October. It's a Tuesday. Please block it out. Anyway, these glorious truths were there. Back to the dinner party. There I was. We were chatting away and we seemed to have a good chat. It was civilized, the exchange of ideas. We were chatting to each other. And then she got up and I thought she got up and went to the loo, the girl I was sitting next to. But actually, she went into the kitchen and then the hostess came out and discreetly said to me, I'm afraid you've so upset my friend that I'd like to ask you to leave. So I went, and I didn't have any pudding. I mean, it was awful. I missed my pudding. I was so depressed, I went down the street, and there was a newsagent, and I bought myself a Magnum. Just to say, a Magnum is not a bottle of whiskey. I think that's what they think elsewhere. It's an ice cream, a very fine ice cream, but an ice cream. And as you can see, I've had a few. But I mean, what were they expecting? I was a vicar and she asked me. Anyway, there I was. I was out. My words on sex, despite being gently delivered, had created a very tense social situation. And as I say, I didn't get my pudding. And that introduces actually this sermon series a bit. But come to the table, meals with Jesus, because actually we'll see the Lord Jesus Christ give unsolicited feedback in these weeks ahead. Create some very tense social situations at meal times. I mean, I don't know what was said to me after I left that meal, after I left that dinner, but it would be nothing like, I don't think, what was said about Jesus at the end of chapter 9 in Matthew. But the Pharisees said it's by the prince of demons that he drives out demons. This man is the leader of the satanic forces in the world. That's how they concluded the chapter on Jesus after seeing him at the meal. So, you know, we come to this series and I thought, well, lovely, a summer series on meals with Jesus. It'll be gentle, beckoning, wonderful to be together. And then I picked up the Tim Chester book, this book, Meals with Jesus. And let me tell you what he says in chapter one. In Luke's gospel, Jesus got himself killed because of the way he ate. Do you know, it was quite interesting. As we were doing the slides for this, Grace McDowell, who works with me, she was putting the slides together and she saw that slide and she said, I think we'll take the fruit off the slide. Maybe we should, I don't know, put a cross on or boxing gloves. I don't know. But let me tell you, when it comes to Jesus, the thing is, at every meal, he picks a fight. Very, very difficult guy to eat with. So in the series, as it comes up, we'll be looking at Luke 7, Luke 11, Luke 14, Matthew 26, John 21. And can I tell you, there is some massive unsolicited feedback in it. Luke 11, verse 39, at the meal, Jesus says, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. That's the nature of your leadership. Greed and wickedness looks fine on the outside. Your hearts, they're far from me. And then Matthew 26, 21, well, the Last Supper. You know what Jesus says. He turns and he says, truly, I tell you, one of you will betray me. That's a bit of a conversation stopper, isn't it? Someone here is going to betray me. And then even John 21, after the resurrection, that meal by the beach in the morning. And three times he says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Quite a thing to be asked. I tell you, it would have been all over Twitter and Facebook nowadays, wouldn't it? What a series. Hold on to your seats. And this morning, as we come to it, we're going to see two shocks for the religious. Two shocks for the religious as we look down. Well, let's look at the first shock. And the first shock is this. Who is on the guest list? So have a look down, if you would, and look at verse 10 and 11. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why does he do this? Well, there are two groups of people in the passage. There are the goodies and the baddies. I'm not being too technical, am I? You're with me so far, are you? There are the goodies and the baddies. The goodies are the Pharisees. They're some of the senior religious figures of the day. The baddies are people like Matthew, who, verse 9, is sitting at his tax collector's booth. Now, do not think Inland Revenue. That is far too respectable and far too popular. Far too popular to qualify as a tax collector like Matthew. Israel is a theocracy. It sees itself as God's people ruled by God's law, so they don't think so much nationally, Jews against Romans. They think theologically, God against Romans. That's how they're thinking. And the tax collector had opted for the Romans. So, yes, they were traitors to the nation, but they were also traitors to God. They were God's enemies. As he's sitting at that booth, as he's raking in the money and taking his cut, he is declaring himself an enemy of God. Furthermore, the Pharisees believed this Gentile Roman occupation of their promised land would end when Israel became pure. Why has God allowed it? Why has God handed us over to this judgment? Because of our sin, because of our ungodliness. And they exhorted all Jews to observe the purity code, which the Torah only called priests to observe. It was meant to just be for the priests. They said, no, we've all got to do it. So they said, right, to be free of the Romans, we need the ritual purity required of priests in the temple to be practiced in our own homes. So our homes are to be like the Lord's temple. And our dinner tables are to be like the Lord's altar. That's what we've got to understand here. That's the state of holiness we need to be free. Israel's identity and blessed future depend on it. So as Tim Chester says in his book, A Meal with Jesus, he says, doing lunch was doing theology. And this meant a crucial question of the day was this, with whom can I eat? That's at the center of national life. Who can you eat with? I mean, if we don't get this right, the Romans won't leave. We've got to be pure for God to bless us. So when a teacher comes from God, who would you expect him to hang around with? Well, of course, you'd expect him to be with the pure, with the elite, with those who are conducting themselves properly. I mean, instinctively, you'd expect him to be with the goodies. It'd be a bit like prize giving at school. So, you know, the religious get patted on the back while scum like Levi look on. So here's the shock in verses 10 and 11. Have a look down. When the Pharisees saw Jesus eating with many tax collectors and sinners, they asked, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? What is he doing? Israel will never be free from the Romans. God will never release us from this Gentile tyranny. But Jesus says, verse 12, do you see? It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but those who are ill. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Jesus says, you are thinking in the wrong categories. He says, you've got to stop thinking policeman and start thinking doctor. That's what he's saying. And again, as you come to God this morning, I need to ask you that. Are you thinking policeman or doctor? If you think of God as a policeman, you are always trying to keep the criminals off the streets, aren't you? Get the criminals off the street. Clear them away. Clear the streets. And that's the Pharisees' mindset. They're looking for an exclusive church untainted by sinners. But if you think of God as a doctor, you're always wanting to get your healing hands on the sick. The doctor's reaching out to the sick. And Jesus says, look, I'm a doctor. And as a doctor, I'm interested in the sick because sick people know they need me. Well, it's obvious, isn't it? I mean, doctors don't dish out medicine to the healthy. If a doctor comes into your office tomorrow with his scalpel and pills, you'll say, look, you need to go, ma'am, sir, go. Your priority's with the sick. And Jesus says here, if you think you're good enough without me, healthy enough without me, then you won't want me if you're righteous enough without me. So just as healthy people don't want doctors, so good people don't want me. No, says Jesus, I've come for sinners. He says, if you're sick, you're my number one priority, spiritually sick. He says, I've come for people who realize they've not let God be God and they're rebels in God's world. So love God with heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the key word in that little verse is all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. Got to be kidding. Never done it. Love your neighbor as yourself, if only. There's a malevolence and a manipulation in the way I relate to my neighbor. Or I just ignore them entirely. And Jesus makes it quite clear that he's interested in people who realize they're bad, not in people who think they're good. So it's interesting here, isn't it? I wonder if you've got this. The key qualification for coming to Jesus is not, are you good enough, but are you bad enough? And I fear that as some came out this morning, as you came out, you looked up and down your street and you thought, well, at least someone on the church is on the street is going to church. At least someone on the street does their duty as you got into the car or came to the tube and came here. And maybe there was just that little tickle of superiority in your tummy as you came along. Just the butterfly of, oh, at least I do my duty and come to church. Look at them all. They're all in bed. Do you know, if you're in that place where your experience of religion is, and you'd never say it, but inside just feeling slightly superior to others, can I tell you, you are in a very, very dangerous place spiritually. And you're a million miles from Jesus Christ. And you know, it's interesting in my family, I mean, the family I come from, I thought, in terms of my experience of faith growing up, I thought only good people can come to Jesus. And my grandmother died saying, because I'm good, God will accept me. That's what she said as she was dying. I'm a good person. God will accept me because I'm good. It's a million miles from Jesus. Again, can I say the qualification for coming to him is not are you good enough, but are you bad enough? So I came to Jesus because I'm a bad man. That's why I came. Okay, well, let's continue with this. Well, how does Matthew come to host the party? I mean, it's a shocking party. Look who he's got on the guest list. What about the host? Well, let's see how he comes to be involved. Verse 9, have a look down. He gives us a little bit of autobiography. Have a look down, verse 9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him. And Matthew got up and followed him. Now, just to say, the word follow me here is not an invitation. It's not that. No. Ladies and gentlemen, the word follow me here is a military command. Think parade square. Think the sergeant. Think the RSM barking out orders. follow me. You don't disobey that. So Jesus walks past Levi's booth and he issues a command. And the key phrase here is the word got up. Can you see it there in verse 9? He told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. Now, what's interesting about this word is that it comes previously in chapter 9, verses 6 and 7, the previous little cameo. In verses 6 and 7, Jesus is with a paralyzed man. The man cannot walk. His legs are utterly dysfunctional. And Jesus says to the paralyzed man, get up, take your mat. Then the man got up and went home. Well, it's amazing. Can you see the two got ups? One, well, it's impossible for the paralytic to walk physically. And Jesus heals him. And can you imagine it? No wonder this went round the ancient world. No wonder it got into the Jerusalem Times. I mean, tendons and sinews and bones knit together and are formed, and up he gets. But if you think, well, that's exceptional, well, there's another miracle next to it, and it's Matthew, who leaves a hugely lucrative profession where he's extorting people, and he gets up as well and is given a new heart and a new mind and writes a gospel that changes the world. I mean, can you imagine his wife's astonishment? In the morning, she gives him a customary peck on the cheek and waves him goodbye. And he walks out of the house with a job and his sandwiches, the lunch under his arm, doubtless lobster sandwiches, don't you reckon? Off he goes. Got the sandwiches, perhaps a little champagne for lunch. I mean, that's normal. He's a rich man. Well, he's back a few hours later, unemployed, with 30 at dinner and a surprise retirement party. Can you imagine it? Can you see why this is happening? Well, it's because Jesus is in charge. That's why it's happening. Jesus is calling, and that is Christianity. It isn't so much something that you take up, Christianity, you know. It's not something that you take up. Christianity is something that takes you up. That's what it is. You get taken up by Christianity. You see, what happens is this. You sense a power coming from outside and taking charge. I mean, look at Matthew. He's at work. Well, he's not got time for interruptions. Just imagine yourself, you're at the desk. People are coming to you. They're paying you something. You're writing in your ledger. There you are. You're writing in the ledger. You're concentrating. It's Mr. So-and-so. It's Miss So-and-so. You're crossing off the names in the ledger. And then Jesus comes along, and he comes along, and he says, follow me. Ladies and gentlemen, Matthew's not looking for this. He's not praying for this. But he hears the call. Follow me. And doubtless, as he heard the call, he thought, me? But there's a power outside himself, profoundly, profoundly at work. And there's a new authority in his life. You see, that's what Jesus says in all these meals. One way or another, he says again and again, he says, who's the authority in your life? You or me? It's a power coming from outside yourself. Now, there are different ways in which we might describe it. You might find this power from outside yourself coming in the midst of intellectual experience as you're reading and reading. It might be an emotional experience. It might be an invitation at a service. It might be a course. It might be being overwhelmed by nature. But the key is this, ladies and gentlemen, the key is this. Jesus is taking charge. And people sit there and they say, well, look, I've got great questions about sexuality. I don't know where I stand on that. It seems very countercultural what you believe. And you're calling for this celibacy. It's Jesus. It's Jesus who made the world. He's taking charge. And so all those questions, well, they're there. But can I tell you, the overwhelming one is, well, who do you think he is? And this power is coming and taking charge and has total authority. So, that's the first shock. Who's on the guest list? Answer, sinners. And who put them there? Well, Jesus calls Matthew. He selects him. Can you imagine the other disciples going, no, don't leave. No, look, it'll be terrible for our image. Really, not him. He's a dreadful chap and he's fleeced all of our families. No, Jesus. Oh. Well, what's the second shock? What's the second shock? What is true religion? Matthew 9, verse 13. Have a look down. Striking stuff. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I've not come to call the righteous but sinners. Go and learn what this means. That's a rabbi's rebuke, ladies and gentlemen. It meant, why don't you go and do some Bible study? Oh, it'd be great to have you on Tuesday night. It's going to be great. So looking forward to it. But Jesus would have said, now, I think you better go Tuesday. Why don't you do some Bible study? Only here, Jesus delivers it to the Pharisees, the Bible experts. Well, the quote here is from Hosea 6, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And in that chapter, and they'd have known it, it's such a rebuke, the chapter Hosea 6, to religious types who've reduced their religion to cold ritualism. Yeah, they had routine sacrifices, but that's about it. So their love for God was as insubstantial and fleeting as a morning mist. You know, it's gone, the sun comes up. So it's there at 7 o'clock, there's a great mist at 7. By 10, it's all gone. Hosea 6, verse 4, your love is like the morning mist, like the early dew that disappears. There's no sign of it later in the day after you've done your ritual, your legalism. Nowhere to be found at 10 o'clock. And then, not just that, I mean, it gets more brutal. Hosea 6, verse 9. He goes from the vertical to the horizontal. And look what he says there. As marauders lie in ambush for a victim, so do bands of priests. They murder on the road to Shechem, carrying out their wicked schemes. So he says, your priests, they're people with blood on their hands. And Jesus says, that's you, the Pharisees. He says, you look spiritual, you look healthy, you look righteous, but you're like this. Vertically, your love disappears like the morning mist. Horizontally, you destroy people. So what was the basic lesson the Pharisees had not grasped? Oh, this was the word they hadn't internalized. They had not internalized the word, can we see it as we look down? Mercy. Mercy. That's what they hadn't got. Now, what is mercy? Mercy means not giving someone what they rightly deserve. Mercy means not abandoning people despite their sin and their unfaithfulness. It's about having pity on people who don't deserve it. They do not deserve it. They've had chance after chance, and yet there's mercy. And here's the issue, ladies and gentlemen. God's character is one of mercy. And the Pharisees should have learned that in Sunday school. Far from giving us what our sins deserve, far from making us pay every penny, God's great desire is to give the religious no-hoper a second chance. And that's why Jesus quotes from Hosea. Do you know the story of Hosea? I'm sure you remember it. Hosea, God's prophet, is told to go and marry Gomer. That's the woman who's to be his wife. The only issue here is that she's the local prostitute. And God says, Hosea, I want your family life to be a picture of what Israel has done to me. So just as she's unfaithful to you, that's what the nation has done to me. So there's Hosea, and there's Gomer, Hosea's wife. She wears very short skirts. She gives out her phone number to Hosea's friends. She says, come round when he's out and bring some money. And Hosea forgives her again and again and again. He keeps having mercy. And can I tell you, you can't really be Christian unless you get to the point where you go, I'm Gomer. That's who I am in terms of how I treat my Creator. But mercy is why God kept rescuing the Israelites. This is why he kept persevering. This is why in his humility he sends his Spirit who, in his humility, contends with us again and again and again. So do you see what Jesus is criticizing the Pharisees for? For all their outward performance, they've distanced themselves from the religious outsider. They haven't gone into the world. They haven't got alongside a non-believer. Instead, they developed a religion that built barriers between them and the world, and they despise the religious no-hoper. And God says, you're meant to have mercy on those people. So look down at verse 11. Do you see? Can you hear the venom in it? The question. They're not meant to despise these people. They're meant to have mercy. And yet they say, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why? How dare he? Where's the mercy? But God's Son is passionately concerned for the religious outsider. He's prepared to leave the glory of heaven for us, to be born in a stable for us, to have his hands and feet pierced for us. He dies on a cross to pray for our sin. He's prepared to go to hell for us. And so true godlikeness, true godliness is about having a heartfelt passion for the religious outsider. Can I ask you, do you? We've heard this morning about planting churches across Europe. And Europe's more outside than anywhere. Is that going to touch me? Have I got a heart for it? Do you have a passion for your outside, for the outsider, your next door neighbor? Do you even know their name? You see, real godliness means being like God and having the same priorities as God. And the big surprise, here's the big surprise, Matthew's more godly than the four Pharisees. Because what's the first thing he does when he discovers God's Son has come to rescue him? He has a party and invites all his friends to meet him. He says, you've got to meet him. And as the Pharisees look down their noses in horror, they're being very ungodly. So you see, they may give, fast, pray. They may go to every church meeting. It's all good things. But they despise the religious outsider. And therefore, they are very, very, very ungodly with their sense of superiority. And Jesus says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. So to seek the lost is to be like God. Now, this is the issue in our thinking in our churches. Time and again, what we've done is this. We have separated godliness from evangelism. We seem to think they're separate. And we have a model of godliness that actually doesn't have much to do with evangelism. Whilst John Chapman, the Australian evangelist, said again and again and again, you cannot be godly. You cannot be godly and not be concerned for the lost. God was so concerned for the lost, he sent his son to die. What does it mean to be like God? Exhibit A, Jesus, you go to the lost. Oh, what's your priority? And are you so in the Christian ghetto that you can no longer be godly? Are you so in the Christian ghetto that you can no longer be godly? And Jesus says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. His priority, one, are the religious no-hopers. So the no-hoper in your office, priority one, whose language is terrible, priority one. And if we distance ourselves from them, we need to go back to Sunday school, despise them, and we're being ungodly because his priority is sinners first. And remember, and I close with this, please remember, ladies and gentlemen, in all this, God is the evangelist. God's the evangelist. He's the one seeking the lost. He's the one who sent his son. He seeks the lost. He seeks the ungodly. He seeks the rebel, the tax collector. 2 weeks ago, my uncle died. My name is Richard Ian Tice, and the man who gave me that name, the middle name, was my uncle Ian, who died. And he was a kind, loving uncle, but at no point in the last 30 years did he ever express any interest in the Christian faith whatsoever. I sent him books, I sent him DVDs. He was a very committed Mason, and that was where he was. As far as I know, the books and DVDs I sent were never watched. Anyway, he was dying, and he's my uncle, and I'm named after him. And I felt I had to go, and he was up in a hospital in North Wales, which is a five-hour journey away. But anyway, the great thing is I only work one day a week, so I could go. So I went up to see him. I had time to do it. And I went, you know, why did I go? I went because I believe in hell. I believe in hell. I mean, I think Jesus has done everything possible to save us from that. But if we die and stand before God with our sin unpaid for, Jesus, the most loving man that ever lived, says there's a place called hell. And I just couldn't get this out of my head. So I said, I've got to go up and see him and try and plead with him to accept Jesus. So I traveled halfway up to North Wales, and I got there, and he was really touched I came, and he gave me a huge hug, and I offered him communion, and he didn't want it, and I nervously sort of tried to say, look, do you have a faith? And he was gracious but ignored the question. And I took his hand as I was leaving. He wasn't well, so I was only there, I guess, 20, 25 minutes, and I prayed with him, and I said, Lord, may this... My dear uncle, may he understand the forgiveness of Good Friday and the hope of Easter Day. And I left shoulders drooped to catch the train back to London. And I felt so despondent as I walked out of the ward. Anyway, as I got to the corridor and to the lifts, as I stood at the lift opened and a man came out wearing a dog collar. And he said, oh, I'm on the wrong floor. And I said, no, you're not. I said, look, I'm a vicar and I live in London and my uncle is in Ward 4, Bed 8, and his name is Ian, and you must visit him. And I said, and please blame it on me. Tell him his nutty nephew sent you. And he said, okay, I'll visit. And he went then, and then he went again the next morning. And a week later, I rang him, and he said, by the way, he said, I just think you should know. He said, I'm not the hospital chaplain. He said, my wife is ill on the fourth floor. He said, that's why I was there. And he said, I was on the second floor because I was lost. So anyway, I spoke to him the day after my uncle died. And he said this to me. He said, look, he said, I gave him the last rites. He said, he didn't seem to like it much, but I gave them anyway, he said. Now, what do you do with that? What do you do with that? I mean, really, what do you do with it? My uncle had hardened his heart to God all his life, all the time I know him. Yet God, in his mercy, was reaching out to him to the end. What mercy, what kindness, what a doctor, what a God we have. Let's pray together. Well, two questions from this dinner party that rocked the religious. Who's on the guest list and what's true religion? Lord God, please give us a heart like Jesus for the outsider. Oh, forgive us when we set up barriers. Help us, please, to have mercy as you have had mercy on us. And help us to trust in your call as you've called us. Amen.